Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Syria. Many people who watch the politics in the Middle East have argued for some time now that Syria has an important role to play in the region, certainly in the future of Iraq, although until very recently the United States has refused to talk with the Syrian government. In this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about Syria and the region, about its involvement in Lebanon, its relationship with Israel, and this larger role that it might play in the politics of the region. And our guest for the program is Bassam Haddad. He is assistant professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He's also a scholar in residence at University of Pennsylvania and visiting professor at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the Arab Studies Journal and has written a good deal about Syria. He's working, in fact, on a book looking at the political economy of Syria. That's a project based on his dissertation. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief as can be. We just ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But callers are an important part of the show and are welcome to call in and share their thoughts and their questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are certainly welcome. Just pick up the telephone and dial the number, and we'd be happy to talk with you. Professor Haddad, hello.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Anytime.
I realize this is perhaps a large question to start with, but let me ask you, and you can talk a bit about it. If you look at Syria today as it is under Bashar al-Assad, and you make then comparisons between that and what Syria was like when his father, Hafez al-Assad, was the president, what would you say were the important differences, or are there important differences? Has Syria really changed dramatically since Hafez al-Assad died in 2000?
Sure. Are we on the air?
Yes.
Yes, good, because it sounds a little different. The most significant difference between Bashar and Hafez Assad is basically their constitution. Hafez Assad grew up in an era where colonialism was a fact, and it was basically the determinant of all politics. And his politics was very much geared, as he grew up, towards not just establishing national independence, but also towards weeding out all kinds of potential agents of international forces, or usually European forces at the time. So he was very much guided by this kind of reality. Now, there are many other details, but the Bashar situation is very different. Bashar grew up in a home of the president of Syria that had become a major force in the Middle East, whereas Assad grew up in a Syria that was a pawn in the hands of various regional and international players. So Bashar, on the one hand, is perhaps a little bit less xenophobic, a little bit more confident, and grew up in a Syria where the social background of the his social background is considered a decent, a good, a respectable social background, whereas Hafez al-Assad grew up in Syria where his social background as a rural Alawi minority member was actually looked down upon by the establishment Sunni society in urban Syrian cities. So these are basic differences, but the more significant differences have to do with special personality traits that Assad had. Assad was a maverick that is of global proportions. This man was able to do for Syria internally, regionally, and internationally what very few leaders could have done with a country that has very few resources and has limited capacity, militarily and otherwise. Bashar is far less experienced politically, and he has to rely on a group of other leaders within Syria to make decisions. So the kind of purposefulness with which Bashar does politics is a bit compromised by, I don't want to say this is a bad thing, because there are many voices, but those voices are not necessarily democratic voices. So there's a little bit of a hesitance in Bashar's policies. If we notice from 2000 until today, there's a little bit of hesitance, and there's stops and starts. But the world has also changed. That's the third level. Hafez Assad grew up in a world where you could always rely on another big player, the Soviet Union, until, of course, the last decade before his death. Bashar grew up in a world, or became president in a world, where we have a unipolar world with the United States pretty much dominating even the region. And that makes for a much more challenging role for Assad, which forced him to reach out to actors like Iran, which his father did, but not in the way that Bashar is forced to reach out to Iran. So that creates for a whole different situation. And I'll stop here because, mm-hmm. I mean, there are other things to discuss. Sure. But.
Well, just a couple of other points to follow up. I guess one just, again, worth mentioning is that even though, as you say, that Bashar grew up the son of a president, he was not the heir apparent. There was an older brother. The idea was that that brother would become president. Well, he was killed in a car accident in 1994, and so suddenly now things change. So until he was an adult, I'm sure that Bashar felt that his life was going to go into in a different direction. So his preparation to be president was hasty and was not exactly what was intended. So it wouldn't be surprising if even at this point he was still kind of feeling his way along.
Yeah, sure. Until he was 30 or 29, when his brother was killed in a car accident in 1994, Bashar was not considering a career in politics at all. Actually, he was quite far from it. But since 1994, when he was about 29, he was groomed, or began to be groomed, as the heir, as the successor. So those 6 years were extremely crucial in his development, because he was given various responsibilities progressively, beginning with some internal matters, and then by 1998 he became the person in charge of what is called the Lebanon file, and very quickly became a regional figure. So that by the time Assad died in 2000, and actually I was in Syria writing at the time, Bashar was clearly the heir to Assad, even though there were some squabbles over that, because of his age, because of his distance from politics, and precisely because he was seen as unsuitable to run a country like Syria that required a quote-unquote a tough guy, which Bashar was not viewed to be. And that kind of image, maybe somewhat close to the image of George Bush Sr. here in the United States, was something that haunted Bashar, but he showed in various ways that although he is not going to be the kind of leader that his father was in terms of being tough and quote-unquote sometimes brutal, he did actually move to crack down on corruption within the regime, actually corruption selectively, let me say, because, of course, the entire Syrian regime is quite problematic and authoritarian and has islands of corruption that must go on in order to keep the regime alive. But Bashar did show that he is able to challenge some of the major players in the field, and so much so that by 2005, which is summer 2005, which is the time when the Syrian or the Ba'athist regional conference was held, most, if not exactly all, the players that were opposed to Bashar's succession were actually removed from the ruling Ba'ath party, or from the top ranks of the ruling Ba'ath party, and replaced by loyalists to Bashar. And that movement, that shift in 2005, consolidated a regime for 5 years was a bit wobbly. And today, the Bashar regime, one can argue without much controversy, that the Bashar regime today is quite solid, despite a lot of the analysis that that we hear and read about here and there that is not grounded in what is happening in Syria, but in perceptions and impressions.
Very quickly, then our guest, Bassam Haddad. He is assistant professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. That's in Philadelphia. He is also editor, founder of the Arab Studies Journal and has written quite a lot about the politics of Syria. Questions here, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that there was this expectation that after Hafez al-Assad died and Bashar became president, there would be the possibility for many people, perhaps they thought that there would be the hope of both political and economic reform in Syria, and that really didn't happen, or at least perhaps it didn't happen to the extent that people would have liked. Can you talk about that?
The possibility of for some reason I lost you for one moment.
That is when there was this change of the administration, when the son took over from the father. I think that there were a lot of people that hoped there would be the possibility of reform, both political reform and economic reform, and that promise was not fulfilled.
Yes, the idea, I mean, there's a lot of misconception here. First, not in what you said, but in the literature out there on how the coming of Bashar was to usher in a new era. Actually, the quote-unquote new era was ushered in 1998 when the Assad regime and Assad himself began to notice two things. The first thing he began to notice is that he no longer has supreme power in Syria in the manner that he had before. There were voices in Syria beginning in the mid to late 1990s that have crystallized in 1998 around the president, the senior Assad. And this is something that very very few people would point to or know. But few people around him, strongmen, began to challenge his authority in a subtle manner. That created a serious problem for Assad because of the various situations taking place at the time inside Syria. And we can go over the domestic politics, if you like, in detail. But this created one cornerstone of the decision. The other is the faltering economy, the economy of Syria, after enjoying a serious, what can be called a speculative boom in the early to mid-1990s, came crashing hard in 1996, causing serious economic distress for various parts of the Syrian society that actually were benefiting from the regime and began actually to reconsider their not alliances, because they were not willingly allies. They just were natural allies because of their labor positions and because of their the welfare that the state granted them and so on. So because of the economic decline and internal, or the beginnings of serious internal turbulence that was kind of muted to the public, Assad began a series of reforms to deal with these issues and to open the door for his son. In other words, the reforms were intended to weed out, beginning in 1998, the opposition to his son, including Hikmat Jihabi, who is the basically the head of the army in Syria. And he is the principal critic of Bashar Assad, who publicly criticized Bashar by saying many things that pointed to Bashar's lack of experience, age, and so on and so forth. So but by 1998, these reforms started politically and economically. Nothing revolutionary, nothing to the extent that the regime claims. It never is in authoritarian regimes. But there was a movement beginning in 1998. It fell short of completing the shift by 2000 when Assad died. The forces who remained included his vice president, Abdel Halim Khaddam, who was still in power when Assad died in 2000. So that created problems for Bashar, along with various elements in the security forces. There are nine branches of the security forces in Syria. They were split between supporters and opponents of Bashar. So Bashar and company at the time had to actually spend the next 5 years to weed out the remaining critics, opponents, who wanted a different kind of Syria, a Syria that resembled more the Syria of the 1970s and 80s, so as to preserve the longevity of the regime. Bashar and friends were convinced not in the values of opening Syrian society and Syrian politics, but they were convinced that unless Syrian economy and the Syrian political system began to liberalize, Syria would fall apart. So it was not a conflict between reformers and conservatives, those who wanted to conserve the system. It was a conflict between those who wanted to keep the system the way it was and those who wanted to begin decompressing the system slowly. And that is that was the situation at the turn of the century when Bashar took over. The way it was portrayed in the media, even in much of the Arab world and clearly in the West, in the United States and Europe, was that it's a conflict between these two opposites. So when that did not happen, it became a thing to write about. Oh, look at the Syrian Spring. It did not really amount to much. But it was never supposed to amount to much if you were paying attention to those writers in 1999 and 2000, 2001, who were saying that very little is going to change. So it's not a puzzle. It's a puzzle that we created, and now we feel disappointed. But it was never a puzzle for those who were following Syrian politics or know the politics of authoritarian regimes in regions with high levels of turmoil. They're not likely to change dramatically. They will decompress. They will selectively liberalize, but then crack down upon opposition, which is what the Syrian regime did back and forth between 2000 until today.
Mm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation when we do that, someone who's listening up in Milwaukee, and we'll go there, our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, David. Mm-hmm. I'd like to refer to the new Seymour Hersh article. It's in the March 5th New Yorker. It's called The Redirection. It's about the general escalation Bush is making in the Middle East. And I'd like to refer to some of the parts about Syria. In addition to Bush's public threats against Syria, he's now running what are called clandestine operations against Syria. And part of that is funneling money to an extremist group to try to destabilize the Syrian government. And that group, according to Hersh, is a Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. I wonder if the guest could help us understand why Bush would be doing something like this clandestine.
Okay. Professor Haddad, can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I mean, with all due respect to Seymour Hersh and considering that what he has written about, or much of what he's written about, has sort of unfolded in a similar direction in reality, but this is one of the more muddy speculations, because not because it's impossible for the United States to do that, simply because of the logic that the U.S. wouldn't want an alternative that is an Islamist. That's not true. With the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood has historically had cold and warm relations with the United States, and its leaders now residing in the United Kingdom have been said to be in direct contact behind corridors with U.S. officials. And they were actually chastised for that in Syria by members of the opposition to the regime, even, because the idea was we are opposed to the Syrian regime in Syria. That is, the idea is that we are opposed to the Syrian regime. We think it should either go away, transit to democracy, even be held accountable for its crimes over the past three decades. But we definitely do not support the U.S. Model of regime change. And they were viewing the Muslim Brotherhood leaders, or some of them, as connecting with the United States, perhaps for the purpose of such a change. So this is not an impossible situation that the U.S. would be speaking with the Muslim Brotherhood. But to funnel arms, or to funnel intelligence, or to actually support materially the Muslim Brotherhood inside Syria might be pretty not just hasty, but irresponsible, because the Muslim Brotherhood might actually be overrun internally by far more extremist forces, because the Muslim Brotherhood is not an extremist force, either in Egypt or in Syria. It's actually a moderate Islamist force, moderate meaning that they have not taken up violence in Egypt. In Syria, they've taken up violence in the late 70s and early 1980s, but they've been pretty quiet, the establishment, that is. But there are far more extremists, and I use the word extremist with caution, because I don't want it to be mixed with the way it's being used in our media here in the U.S., extremist meaning ready to go move from civil to violent means. There are far more extremist forces in Syria that might take over what the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to do. So for the U.S. not to U.S. Decision makers not to recognize that, or to recognize that and think that it can be held under control, they're repeating the same exact thing that happened in various parts of the Middle East as a result of their support of what they originally or naturally consider unsavory actors. Whether you look at the Mujahideen, whether you look at Saddam Hussein, the Muslim groups in Egypt in the 1970s that they supported to weed off the leftist remnants of the Nasser regime, they all came back to haunt either the U.S. itself, its interests, or its allies. So I would look at this development with caution. It's more likely that the U.S. is supporting people like al-Ghadri, who is a leader, a Syrian quote-unquote leader that resides in the United States, who is a secular. He's connected with the Center for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. It's a foundation, sorry. It's a think tank. And it's the kind of route that the U.S. has been taking, pushing alternative secular leaders like this gentleman, like others in Europe. But meddling with the Muslim Brotherhood is from the perspective of U.S. decision makers, is playing with fire. So I wouldn't know why they would be doing that.
Would you put it past President Bush to be waging some kind of covert war against Syria?
No, of course I do not. I just think that the means, we can speculate as to how irrational our current administration can be in the Middle East simply because of its recent record. But I think there's a limit to how adventurous, irrational, and foolish we can be. I mean, after all, the decisions made in the United States by the administration are not made by one person, no matter what the caricature is.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other calls are welcome. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with Bassam Haddad. He is assistant professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. That's in Philadelphia. He's also a scholar in residence at University of Pennsylvania and visiting professor at Georgetown University. He is the founder and the editor of the Arab Studies Journal and has been following the politics of Syria for quite a long time. He's working on a book, in fact, on the political economy of Syria based on his dissertation. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I wonder, maybe you might want to expand just a little bit on your response to the caller. I'm interested in having you talk about the whatever kind of is there a kind of significant Islamist opposition in Syria that would be in the position to pose some challenge to the Syrian government?
The situation with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria is very different than with other the presence of Islamists in other Arab countries, because of the debilitating attack on the headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, or one of the main headquarters in Hama in 1982. The Syrian regime, after repeated attempts by the Muslim Brotherhood to destabilize the regime and protest not only the secular nature of the regime, which is basically the stereotypical characterization of the situation, but also to protest the economic policies of the regime that were goring the interests or harming the interests of the petit bourgeoisie in the urban markets, which are run mainly by people connected to Islamist groups, to the Muslim Brotherhood. So it was a political and economic protest. But in response, the Syrian regime, led by the president's brother, Rifat Assad, who now resides in Spain, undertook an attack on the northern Syria of Hama, which claimed anywhere between, depending on who you listen to, 12 and 25,000 deaths in the northern Syria, northern city of Hama, destroying much of that historic city. After that, the Brotherhood was extremely quiet until today. We have 25 years of very quiet Muslim Brotherhood. It still exists, but it cannot. It is not the kind of force that that exists in Egypt, even at the civil level, because of the prohibition against public organizing. What you have in Syria is not an official organization of an Islamist voice. What you have in Syria is an informal current of resentment by people with Islamist sympathies that are not organized. They're actually quite atomized. They don't know each other, but they exist throughout the Syrian regime so long as the economic and political crisis continues, and it has been continuing, and so long as actually poverty grows and people cannot actually join any other kind of political force in the country because they don't exist other than the Ba'ath Party. So for the past 25 years, especially in the 90s and the past few years, there's been a sentiment that is latent, that is sitting in the background and waiting either to organize if the state allows for law number 8 to be reformed or changed so that people can organize around whatever political party they feel is appropriate for them, or for some big shock to take place. I doubt that the big shock that took place in Iraq would work in Syria for various reasons, but the organization of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria does not have the kind of organizational muster that can actually amount to anything more than chaos, because they're truly not organized in Syria, and they, you know, there's no such thing as an Islamist current or the Muslim Brotherhood current period in the world. There are people who adhere to certain versions of Islam. So even if you have an Islamist tendency in the public in Syria that is latent, it doesn't mean that these people will agree with each other and actually form an alliance. If they don't have the opportunity to organize, which they don't, it is anyone's guess what will come of any kind of change, because they will not necessarily be allies. So we have a quite stable situation in Syria, whereby the Islamists cannot mount any serious or sustainable attack. So this is one of the other reasons why I feel that speculations that the U.S. is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood are suspect. Hmm.
Just to turn to Syria's a rather different subject, Syria's interest in Iraq. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I think that many people have been saying for some time now that if the United States is interested in trying to stabilize Iraq and have some stability in the region, then the United States has to be willing to talk with the governments of all of the countries in the region, something to which previously the United States had said, no, we won't do that, and particularly singling out the governments of Syria and Iran. Well, now we have just within the last week or something a significant change. At least now there is going to be a meeting, and I believe it is taking place tomorrow, involving governments of the region, that there will be a presence from both Syria and Iran. And now the United States has said it will participate. I wonder what you think about that change. And then also, what if you could talk a little bit about what Syria's interests in Iraq are.
Well, I'll start with the second part. Syria's besides the politics, because we can all have our politics, in other words, our politics against the occupation in Iraq, against the U.S. presence in Iraq, our politics for or against certain Palestinian groups or the presence of Israel or Israel's interest in the region or in Iraq specifically, and what's happening between Syria and Lebanon, Syria and Israel. But I think it's really productive to go back to the basics. Syria is an authoritarian regime. An authoritarian regime is a regime that runs on various mechanisms and rests on the principle of unaccountability, and that despite existing resistance. Its interests in Iraq cannot be other than whatever keeps or maintains Syria's current regime. In other words, its interest in Iraq during the Saddam era were basically economic, that were cut off in the late 1970s because of a personal feud between the two presidents, which prevented Syria from making more than $1 billion a year simply by letting Iraq run its pipelines through Syria and cost Syria so much until the late 1990s. So the interest in Iraq today is to prevent the instability in Iraq to creep into Syria, at the same time to prevent the U.S. from becoming more emboldened by whatever might happen in Iraq that might embolden the United States. So for Syria, a weaker Iraq that is not chaotic is something that the Syrians will not mind, except that it will have an economic cost, because the Syrians can gain much from economic relations with Iraq on various levels. But the Syrian regime has actually gained in a very odd way from what is happening in Iraq, because the calls for change of regime in Syria that we heard in the late 1990s and the early 2000s are not heard in the same way, although you keep hearing them today, but they're not heard in the same way because of what is happening next door. So people have sort of suspended their vitriolic rhetoric against the regime when it comes to the demand for a quick, immediate regime change. So in that sense, Syria has benefited. I think we will see a much more cooperative role by Syria in the region once the attack on Syria subsides by the United States and the Europeans, the attack that is connected to the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafi Hariri in Lebanon. Once we see an end to the policy of isolating Syria in the region, and Syria is actually using this card in a very effective way, and the U.S. knows that the Syrians are using this card, the U.S. administration, that is. And that's why they refrained from cooperating and working with Syria until tomorrow, until this latest episode, when things in Iraq are going so badly that the U.S. Is willing to actually sit down, as it was not earlier, with everyone, actually, and talk. And we just heard today that the EU plan to do something revolutionary, which is to re-engage Syria after more than 2 years of isolating Syria and kind of ignoring Syria altogether, not just politically but also economically. And there were economic deals that were underway between Syria and EU that were interrupted by the Hariri assassination. So what we are seeing today, whether or not anyone likes it, what we are seeing today is a repositioning in Syria, in the region, that actually might contribute to some sort of stability, but will undermine U.S. hegemony or domination.
Well, just to again touch on the subject of the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, this was the winter, February of 2005. He was a former prime minister of Lebanon, and he was killed in Beirut by a car bomb. And many people in Lebanon and around the world believed that Syria was responsible. And there was a lot of pressure brought to bear on Syria. And as a result, and one of the things the Syrians did was they pulled all their troops out of Lebanon. Now is in the interest of getting serious cooperation with Iraq and with this region, you make it sound like the rest of the world is willing to back off on this pressure to get some sort of resolution and to perhaps establish who exactly was responsible for Hariri's death. Is that just now going to be swept aside?
Well, I mean, theoretically, absolutely, the world will not the world, but the U.S. will easily back off the Hariri investigation for something much larger. I mean, this is not what is odd. What is odd is the amount of interest or the interest and the attention that overcame the entire world because of the Hariri assassination. This is what is odd. This is what is really actually kind of comical. When all of this chaos and mayhem is taking place in the region, and when you know, various other things are taking place globally, we find our president and his aides and other government officials speaking about Lebanon as if almost as if it was the Soviet Union. Every other day we heard something about Lebanon. This is what is really kind of comical from an informed perspective. The natural size or weight or gravity of the Hariri assassination might be assumed as a result of this more rationalist policy. It doesn't mean that they will ignore it, but it means it will be given due attention, as the prime minister of a pretty vibrant but small country was assassinated, and who's a very well-known and influential figure, not just politically but economically, globally speaking. Sure. But what we might see is a restoration to the natural weight of this crime, of this assassination, in favor of other rational policies in countries in, like Iraq right now, and in the region that involves Iran and so on. Calculations that might be far more consequential than whether we find out or not find out who killed al-Hariri.
Well, what can Syria do? In what way can the government of Syria contribute to some achieving some kind of measure of stability in Iraq? What exactly can the Syrians do?
Okay, well, at the border, they can't do very much. I mean, they can do something, but they cannot do very much. And I'm sick of saying that what everybody's been saying, which is we can't control our own southern border. Why do we expect Syria to control its border, which is actually, well, there's really no border. I mean, there isn't like a wire or anything. Historically, these lands were created, these borders were created artificially by colonialists, which is always the background problem that is never discussed. But let's move on. The idea that Syria can do something in Iraq rests on a number of stipulations. First, that the Syrians would be more active, not in controlling the border itself, but in investigating what is happening in its own cities that is resulting in various kinds of trips, let's call them trips, quote-unquote, to Iraq by some in Syria, some Syrians and non-Syrians who want to cross over to help, quote-unquote, their Iraqi brethren. Not as Muslims, by the way, which is, of course, another one of our silly perceptions, but as Arabs as well. So that is the issue. It's not the border itself. It's the buses early on, much less than now, that would congregate in various Syrian cities and take people to Iraq through these various routes along the border. So that's one thing, but that's no longer the case. So that's less important. The other thing is for the Syrian regime to actually interfere in various cells inside Iraq that are Ba'athist cells to do whatever it can do. I mean, if I sit here and tell you, I know exactly how that might happen. I'd be hallucinating because very few people know. But we have confirmed for the past few years, 2 years at least, 2.5 years, that the know-how and the skill and the weapons for conducting much of these operations come not from right-wing Islamist or Al-Qaeda-type groups, but come from the weapon stock of the Ba'ath Party and the officers that know how to run them, how to control them, and how to explode them, and how to deal with them. And these folks, because our brilliant policy from the time we invaded and occupied Iraq, because we dismantled the army, we created an army that is unemployed, that is very happy to find employment, irrespective of the target at this point, or many of them are involved in giving their know-how. That kind of connection can serve in a future Iraq to perhaps give these folks some sort of a stake in a new, more stable Iraq under the auspices of Syria, the United States, and other Arab and European countries. So Syria can play a role because it is the outlier in the region. It's the only country that opposed the U.S. policy openly from the very beginning. Thirdly, the Syrians have an in with other regional players, including Iran, that it can actually activate regarding the Iraq question. So we've tried to ignore Syria. We tried to wait until the Syrian regime collapsed. We tried to wait until the Syrian people rose. But all of these strategies failed because we failed to, and we do the same thing in Palestine, by the way. We failed to recognize that even though the Syrian people are opposed to the regime generally, they're not happy to see the regime's policies dictated from the outside, and they're happy to sort of sit things out until they can go back and fight their own fight. So these things Syria can offer, and now we know that it's a possibility.
Well, let me just touch on something that you hear that you mentioned that it seems strikes me as important, in as much as the United States recently has been trying to stress its perception, its allegation that elements in Iran are lending weapons and expertise to fighters in Iraq who are then using those against the United States. How would you compare that kind of support that might be coming from within Iran to that kind of support that might be coming from Syria? Because it seems that at least in what the U.S. government says publicly, there's a great deal of emphasis placed on Iran as being an actor in Iraq, and at least to my mind, not very much is said at all about what might be coming from the other side, across this other long border between Syria and Iraq.
I'll tell you a very quick story. It was at one point early on after the war, the U.S. captured a shipment of night vision goggles into Iraq from Syria. And when the claim came back to Syria, and at a press conference, one of the aides of the defense minister of Syria was accused of sending night vision goggles to the resistance or into the insurgency, whatever your flavor is in Iraq. He stopped there and said, what are night vision goggles? What are they for? I mean, the Syrian regime can really cannot be effective in Iraq in terms of sending any kinds of weapons that are going to be used effectively. Iran can, in terms of capability. Iran can, and Iran might actually be doing that, not necessarily just to fight the United States forces, because if you look at the numbers, 100 to 200 Iraqis are dying per day, depending on the week, and very few foreign fighters from Britain or the United States. Iran might have a stake in preventing the Sunni establishment or the Sunni insurgency or the Sunni resistance in Iraq from overpowering the Shiites. So it serves a double purpose. Those weapons, I think it's very rational that Iran would be supporting the Shiites in Iraq to an extent. But of course, once you give that support, you're not able to control how that support is or manifests itself inside Iraq. This is how I would see the Iraqi, the Syrian and the Iranian involvement. It's not the damage that they can do in Iraq that is an issue, because the Iraqis are already likely to wreak havoc with their own government and any occupier. Historically, this is not new. What the Syrians and the Iranians can do, and this is the logic that is bringing everyone to the table now, is contribute to a less chaotic Iraq. This is where the power lies more. not so much in contributing to a chaotic Iraq, because even if they were not involved, Iraq was already devastated by our brutal sanctions that we imposed on the Iraqi people for 12 years that we know very little about here, because it's not important when Iraqis die if our soldiers are not there. So this is the problem, that we've destroyed the Iraqi fabric, so that when there's an occupation from the outside and the failure of institutions internally, what we are seeing today is not a puzzle. It wasn't a puzzle to many of us who were writing in February and March 2003, saying that this is what's likely to happen. Admittedly, none of us realized it's going to be to that extent, but the chaos that's happening today was not a puzzle. So what Syria and Iran can do is contribute to more stability, but they can do very little to make things just much worse.
Mm. We have just a couple of minutes left. We have some other callers. I want to try to get at least one more. Let's go to Champagne for the next line, number one. Hello.
Yes, King Abdullah II of Jordan spoke to, I believe, a joint session of Congress a day or so ago, and he was also in the Lara report, and said that he thought the major way to bring stability to the Middle East was to deal with the Palestinian Israeli conflict, and urge the United States government to be more proactive and more of a broker, unbiased broker in that regard. To what degree can Syria play a role in helping ameliorate the problems associated with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Thank you. King Abdullah has been saying that, and his father have been saying that for decades, and that's just lip service to the question of the injustice done to the Palestinians. That is nothing new. I mean, we all know, even our president, George Bush, actually knows that solving the Israel-Palestinian problem is going to be key in the region. The issue is the political will, as exactly what you said, to actually be not an unbiased, there will be no unbiased actors, but a less biased broker in the region, for the U.S. to be a less biased broker in the region. What the Syria can do, actually nothing, because the Syrian regime has been almost begging, short of begging, the Israelis and the United States to go back to the table for the past several months, covertly and explicitly. So they do want peace. They do want to actually begin or restore the some sort of peace talks, and it's not this. They're pretty much a side player once the U.S. is intent on pushing Israel. But so long as we are pursuing a duplicitous war on terrorism that fights the terrorism we don't like and supports the terrorism we like, there is no hope of the U.S. pushing Israel. And so long as we are present in Iraq amidst this mayhem that whatever we argue that the U.S. invasion created to the large extent, we're going to fail to push any country in the region to do what is rational and what is just unless we can force it to do so. And we've realized that force has been less and less effective during the past few years. So we're kind of stuck. And we're stuck because of our own doing that exposed the gap between our principles and our actions.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We're just down to the point where we're going to have to, we've got about 2 minutes. I do want to ask very quickly if you could talk just a bit about Syria and Israel. I have read some stories suggesting that apparently, or reporting that with over the last couple of years, the two governments have been talking very quietly about seeing if they can work out their relationship together. What possibility do you think there is there for some kind of agreements between Syria and Israel?
I think it's becoming more possible in certain circles in Israel and within the Syrian regime. I'm not sure if the region right now is ready for this because of the kind of nested conflict that we are viewing. I mean, in Lebanon itself, we have so many different factions with different positionality vis-a-vis peace vis-a-vis the end of the conflict scenarios in the region. So I feel that so long as those two factors that I've discussed regarding the quote-unquote war on terrorism that we are launching and regarding the Iraq war, possibilities for a peace that will result in peace is problematic, are very low. After all, Jordan and Egypt engaged in peace plans with Israel, but that actually increased the violence, didn't decrease it. So I'm less interested in sort of peace talks between an authoritarian regime like Syria and a discriminatory regime and military occupation regime like Israel, and more interested in just solutions that give everyone their due.
Well, there we must stop because we're here at the end of our time. Our guest again this morning, Bassam Haddad. He is assistant professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He's also a scholar in residence at University of Pennsylvania and visiting professor at Georgetown. He is the founder editor of the Arab Studies Journal. Professor Haddad, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.